States against Seals.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Justin Weiner. I represent the appellant Christopher Seals in this matter. This is a direct appeal from Mr. Seals' convictions for armed robbery, brandishing a firearm during a felony, and felon in possession in the Northern District of Indiana. I'm here to ask this court today to overturn the convictions for armed robbery and brandishing a firearm because those convictions were based on the admission of propensity evidence that tainted Mr. Seals' original trial. In the alternative, if this court chooses not to remand the case for a new trial, I would also ask the court to vacate Mr. Seals' sentence and remand the case for resentencing based on two sentencing enhancements that the district court erroneously applied. Turning first, Your Honor, to the 404B evidence that was admitted in Mr. Seals' trial, Mr. Seals' conviction stems from the robbery of a PNC bank in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on February 14, 2013. During the trial, the government introduced evidence that 1 month later, on March 13, police responded to a call of men behaving suspiciously near another bank. It turned out to be the Three Rivers Federal Credit Union, and in the ensuing search of the area, recovered a mask that contained Mr. Seals' DNA. That was other act evidence, and to be admissible, it had to satisfy...
Was there an objection at trial to the admission of the mask and the DNA?
There was no objection, Your Honor, to the admission of the mask or the DNA. Only to the chase evidence,
as I understand it.
Yes, only to the evidence of the recovery, the circumstances surrounding the recovery of the mask. Accordingly, Your Honor, that evidence had to satisfy...
I'm sorry, so that is effectively a concession that the DNA on the mask is evidence of the charged offense. The DNA on the mask is evidence of the charged offense.
The trial counsel, Your Honor, conceded in the 404B briefing prior to trial that yes,
okay,
the DNA evidence and the mask itself was admissible. That admission, the concession, perhaps was ill-advised. it may well have been propensity evidence. However, because trial counsel had conceded to it, I'm here today only challenging the admission of the circumstances surrounding the recovery of the mask.
Isn't it a little tough to complain about the circumstances of the recovery when the masks are admissible? Otherwise, it's just a mystery to the jurors what's going on. I don't see how one can concede to the admission of evidence, but object to how the evidence was got at.
Well, Your Honor, it was possible to inform the jury about how the mask was recovered without introducing the details concerning the fact that there were masked men in the woods who were behaving, quote, suspiciously near another bank. It would have been possible to tailor those details more narrowly to exclude those facts. And those are the facts that I challenge now on appeal. It is that the district court allowed one of the government's witnesses, a Fort Wayne police officer.
Yeah, that's what worries me. It sounds like you're saying the district judge should have kept out those details that made this evidence relevant. Because without the details about how the evidence was got by, it wouldn't have been relevant in this prosecution.
Well, Your Honor, in fact, I don't think so. In fact, what the prosecutor argued in the 404B briefing and what the district court held was that the mask was relevant and the DNA was relevant because a similar mask was worn in the PNC robbery. It's not necessary, and so that, I guess, Your Honor, would go to the issue of identity.
Yeah.
Someone's wearing
right,
a mask.
But if the argument is that this was proof of an MO, method of operation, wearing a mask is not an MO. It's not a distinctive MO for bank robbers.
No, it's certainly not, Your Honor. And in fact, the prosecutor conceded that I believe both the mask itself and the circumstances surrounding its recovery were not evidence of a modus operandi. I believe the government's argument in the district court was that because the mask was similar, and this showed that Mr. Seals owned a mask that was used in the PNC robbery or one like it, it was admissible. That is distinct and entirely different from introducing the fact that it was recovered when police were responding to a call of suspicious behavior near another bank. And even though I probably would have objected to the admission of the mask in the first instance, it would not have been difficult or it would not have been necessary to include the details that it was recovered in the woods near another bank when men were behaving suspiciously. Had the district court, as trial counsel suggested, merely said that the police were called and found a mask in the woods at some time later, the details of the suspicious behavior and it being near another bank need not have come in.
And precisely what reference was made to those other details that you view as prejudicial? It looked like it was a very fleeting reference, and in fact, the prosecutor cut off the witness who made a reference to the bank.
Well, Your Honor, it was relatively a brief reference. However, this was a short trial, and well, let me answer your first question first. The details that came in were in the testimony of Christine Armstead, a Fort Wayne police officer,
right.
And that's found in the appendix. I believe it's at A30. And Ms. Armstead testified. First, she confirmed that she was dispatched to a suspicious person's report. She then confirmed that it was a report of some individuals in the woods wearing masks. And then later on in the colloquy with the prosecutor, she confirmed that she was called in the vicinity of a bank, and that was near a bank. And, Your Honor, that's in the trial transcript, day two, pages 53 to 54. Now, the prosecutor did, in fact, cut off Ms. Armstead, but that was because Ms. Armstead was going even further than what the district court had allowed in its pretrial ruling. And Ms. Armstead also said that the individuals had been low-crawling towards the bank and may have mentioned some other details about the individual's behavior. That, however, doesn't change the fact that she still testified to what the district court expressly allowed, which was that the police were called in response to a report of suspicious behavior of men in the woods wearing masks near the Three Rivers Federal Credit Union, which she identified merely as a bank in her testimony. Now, Your Honor, back to your second question, it is also correct that this was a relatively brief reference. However, it still would have caused substantial prejudice in this trial. One, the trial was relatively short, and so the relative time of the reference to the other testimony is larger than otherwise might be. Second, it's a simple issue in a simple trial. The question is Mr. Seals one of the perpetrators of the PNC robbery, or was he not? And so it's not as if there's a bunch of moving parts here for the jury to weigh. Third, Your Honor, is this evidence may have received ample play in the jury's deliberations, and that's because Mr. Seals had an explanation for the rest of the government's evidence. There were two competing inferences or conclusions that could have been drawn from the evidence presented in this trial. One is that Mr. Seals was, in fact, one of the PNC robbers, and the second was that Mr. Seals was the brother of one of the robbers, Charles Seals, and so he was present and near Charles Seals when various pieces of evidence were collected and around, and that would explain a number of details in the government's case. Because of that, the fact that the jury heard that Mr. Seals had participated in something that may have been suspicious near another bank, another alleged, possibly attempted bank robbery, that may well have influenced the jury's decision to choose the government's conclusion over Mr. Seals' conclusion. In that way, Your Honor, this case is not unlike United States v. Owens, in which the jury was faced with two competing stories, and indeed two competing stories in which the government, like this case, had physical evidence of fingerprints in its favor. And ultimately, this court held that the jury was possibly influenced by the improper 404B evidence. The last reason, Your Honor, why this fact may have been received prominent play is the government reemphasized this in closing argument. The government mentioned again that the mask was recovered in the woods in response to a call of suspicious behavior, and then it referred to the mask as a bank robbery mask. There is no such thing as a bank robbery mask. There is a mask that was used in the robbery of the PNC, and the government did not use those words, even though it now claims that's what it meant. It called this mask a bank robbery mask. The government now asserts that its intent was pure when it said this, and it actually meant that it was the mask used in the PNC. However, that's not consistent with what it said in pretrial briefing, nor does it actually matter. What matters is what the jury heard and the inference it could have drawn from that.
Not that I would ever encourage an objection in closing, but the reference to bank robbery mask, was, did that draw an objection?
That did not draw an objection, Your Honor. Now, this evidence of the circumstances surrounding the recovery of the mask from the PNC, this evidence of the circumstances surrounding the mask near the Three Rivers Federal Credit Union, to be admissible, that had to satisfy this court's two-part analysis in United States v. Gomez. It did not. First, the government and then the district court on the record had to identify a non-propensity reason for the evidence. There was none. The government now asserts that it was the circumstances surrounding the recovery of the mask were relevant to three issues: identity, to provide context or complete the story, or to avoid confusion. The first, identity, as we've discussed already, may arguably have applied to the mask itself, but not to the details of suspicious behavior near another bank. The second context, and to complete the story, is a reason for admission that this court has expressly done away with in United States v. Gorman and criticized heavily in United States v. Taylor. In short, under 404B, completing the story is not a proper basis or reason for admitting evidence. And the third, avoidance of confusion, the government cites to one case, but that case does not actually provide it with authority for that being a reason for 404B evidence. That, again, is United States v. Taylor. But in that case, as was pointed out in our brief, this court ended up not even using that as a reason for admitting 404B evidence, and ultimately concluded that the proper remedy, if there was some confusion to be had about why the police were in a certain area, was for the judge to instruct the jury that it was lawful and there was nothing to, it was not a question for them to consider.
Counsel, if the mask and DNA evidence had been admitted without any explanation as to how and where the police obtained it, it wouldn't have much probative value, would it? I mean, there would be certain, I would think that there would at least be questions that could be raised in the absence of a chain of custody, for example, about whether the DNA might have gotten onto that mask through some other activity in the investigation, mishandling of the evidence, for example?
Certainly, Your Honor, in theory, the defense could have raised a chain of custody argument, but it did not. It could have tried to use a district court's limited ruling in some hypothetical world to argue that there was a chain of custody problem. But it did not make that argument, and given that the issue is not actually in dispute, Gomez tells us that it doesn't make the issue relevant for a non-propensity purpose. Second, Your Honor, it is also entirely possible the mask could have been admitted with some further evidence of a chain of custody, with, again, not adding the details that it was recovered under a call of suspicious circumstances near another bank. The second part of the Gomez test is prejudice, is weighing the probative value of the evidence against the unfair prejudice it causes. And here, Your Honor, the prejudice was very, very strong. The mask...
Your time is just about to expire. I think you might want to mention the sentencing issues.
Yes, Your Honor. There were two sentencing issues that we raised in our brief. One was a two-level enhancement for reckless endangerment during flight. That's under 3C1.2.
Counsel, we're familiar with the issues, and time is short. Let me just ask you quickly.
Sure.
I understand your sentencing theory to be that the evidence, that the district court did not make the necessary findings for these enhancements.
Yes, Your Honor.
That is, the evidence might support such findings, but the district court didn't make them.
No, Your Honor. In fact, if it's not clear from the brief, I apologize, but the evidence does not support those findings either.
Couldn't possibly.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, at least with I had understood the argument to be the first, but I guess my question in essence is, how does an objection to the effect that Mr. Seals was not in the car preserve an objection to these additional enhancements?
Your Honor.
Because the district judge was not asked to make these findings. It wasn't challenged on them.
That's correct, Your Honor. However, the trial counsel did make an objection to the sufficiency of the evidence for the findings, notwithstanding the fact that she did not raise the fact that there were other issues beyond him not being in the car that should have been sufficient under this court's prior decisions.
Okay.
If there's nothing further, I'd ask that the court reverse Mr. Seals' conviction and remand for a new trial, or alternatively, remand for resentencing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Whalen.
Thank you. May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Nathaniel Whalen. I'm here on behalf of the United States. The district court did not abuse its discretion in admitting the testimony surrounding the discovery of the mask. Mr. Seals has waived his sentencing arguments, but if this court disagrees, it was not plainly erroneous to apply them. I'd like to talk about the mask evidence for a second. I think Judge Easterbrook and Judge Hamilton, your questions get to the heart of the matter, which is defendant Mr. Seals conceded at the district court, and he conceded here, that the mask and the DNA get in. The government presented the evidence surrounding the discovery of the mask to explain the probative value of the mask, the relevance of the mask, to explain how the authorities came upon it, how the jury could believe that this mask that looked like the one used in the robbery was worn by Mr. Seals at the time of the robbery. Mr. Seals makes a lot of the purported prejudice that came from this testimony, but there was no evidence or testimony that anyone robbed, attempted to rob, or was investigated for robbing the credit union. And I'd like Judge Pallmeyer to raise the issue about the closing arguments. I think that's basically where Mr. Seals' prejudice argument lies. He says that the government asked the jury to draw a propensity inference by calling it a bank robbery mask. With all due respect, there is such a thing as a bank robbery mask. It's a mask that someone uses to rob a bank. And that's what we had here. There are two references to a robbery mask or a bank robbery mask, and they're at pages 37 and 40 of the fourth page of the transcripts, the fourth page of the trial. I'm sorry, fourth day of the trial. The first is that the government's summing up the evidence and says, his DNA is on the gun that was used in the robbery. I'm sorry, and this is on page 37. His DNA is on the robbery mask, and he knows an awful lot about the robbery that didn't come from the news. That's in reference to his statements during the interview with authorities that he learned about the PNC robbery from the news. Linking that robbery with the PNC and then calling it the robbery mask, I think the only inference we were asking to draw and the only reasonable inference the jury could draw is that it was the mask used to rob the PNC. It wouldn't make sense to say that this was the robbery mask in relation to some alleged robbery of the credit union because the jury didn't hear any testimony that there was a robbery or attempted robbery. I think had we made that argument, it would have just confused the jurors. Similarly, on page 40, we call it a bank robbery mask. Say, well, we've got three bank robbery masks. We've got Christopher's, The DNA for this one is for another day, talking about the one found in the Infiniti. And then we can run that testing, can continue the investigation, that sort of thing. But we've already got Christopher Seal's bank robbery mask because he left it behind in the woods out there on Bluffton Road. You know, it was in the course of the government summing up all of its evidence explaining how Christopher Seals was the one who robbed the PNC. The government's asking the jury to find that that mask found on Bluffton Road is the same one that he wore inside the PNC. And that was our theory of relevance. It's a stocking mask. It kind of goes below the neck. It has hand-cut tiny eye holes. And our theory was...
And it was left by the defendant some distance away a month later.
It was left... I think we were arguing that it was left by the defendant, but it was left a month later.
That's just guesswork, though, right?
That is guesswork. We were asking the jury to infer that that mask was the one that he wore in the PNC. To the extent that this court, I guess, has any concerns about this, we argue that the error was harmless. The evidence against Mr. Seals was strong. We have his DNA on a bullet inside the gun left behind at the robbery. We have his DNA on the mask that looks like the one used in the robbery. And we have his kind of backtracking admissions during his interview with authorities, where he says that, well, first he identifies the gun left behind at the scene. And that's information only the robbers would have known. And then he goes forward, and he changes his story. He says, well, I didn't sell a gun to Mr. Stevens. No, I did sell a gun to him. I didn't know they were going to rob. Well, they gave me $200 or $300, but I didn't know they robbed the bank. All right, I knew they robbed the bank. My role was to be quiet. My only role was selling the gun to Mr. Stevens. And then, all right, my brother recruited me to rob it, but I didn't go through with it, is what he says. You know, he just changes his story. He then names eight other people he thinks could have been the robbers. He's changing his story throughout.
I'd like to get to the sentencing issues.
Sure, Judge.
And let me tell you what my problem is. I don't see why what happened a month after the offense is relevant in sentencing. 2K2.1, which deals with the firearms enhancement, specifically says if a gun is used in connection with the offense... What happened a month later wasn't the offense.
Your Honor, there were proceeds from the bank robbery in the back of the car. There was.
So what? The offense is not possessing proceeds later. That's 2113C. The offense was the robbery, A and D.
A and D. I'm sorry, Your Honor. A and
2113 A and
okay,
D.
Right.
That's what
Correct.
The offense was.
Correct. But it... The fact that they had the evidence of the robbery, the offense was
How
still...
How was that in the offense? Since possessing the proceeds sure. of the robbery violates 2113C, and the Supreme Court has said that a person who is convicted of violating 2113A or D cannot be convicted of violating 2113C. So it's not the offense. Sure. It's a different offense.
Judge, there are... I'm sorry, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's my question.
Sure.
How can you get a firearms enhancement for a firearm in connection with a different offense when 2K2.1 is limited to the offense of conviction?
Judge, there were three offenses of conviction in this case. There was the bank robbery, there was the brandishing during the bank robbery, and then mm-hmm. there's felon in possession. The jury had numerous guns in which to base the felon in possession count on. One of them was the gun inside the Infiniti. It was about a month after the bank robbery, but the indictment said on or about February 14th. I think there were a lot of guns that the jury could have based the offense of conviction on.
We're not dealing with what the jury did. We're dealing with what
sure.
the judge did in sentencing.
Sure.
And I wish you'd address my question, which is, since the guideline is limited to the offense of conviction, how can there be an enhancement for what happened miles away a month later?
Because one of the offenses of conviction was being a felon in possession. There was a gun
on
in
the date of the chase.
Pardon?
On the date of the chase.
There is a gun in the car with Mr. Seal's fingerprints on it on the day of the chase. That's
what,
right.
Was that a charge?
Was that the offense of conviction?
The indictment says that there was felon in possession on or about February 14th.
And that was the date of the PNC.
That was the date of the PNC. What the government argued during the course of closing arguments were that there were numerous guns.
I don't care about closing arguments. We're dealing with what the judge did in sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
So your argument is that if you're convicted of being a felon in possession, then if a gun is found any other time in your life, that can lead to an enhancement under 2K2.1?
Not at all, Judge. My argument is that this gun supported the felon in conviction offense.
I don't care whether it supported it. The guideline question is whether it was used in the offense.
Whether it was used? I apologize, Judge. Let me pull up the guideline quickly.
You're saying it's possible the conviction, the jurors convicted the defendant not of the of being a felon in possession in connection with the bank robbery on February 14th, but of being a felon in possession of a weapon at the time of the flight?
I think that's one possible way that they convicted. I honestly don't know which they convicted him of. I think there were multiple grounds.
So you would, if you had prosecuted being a felon in possession at the time of the robbery and a separate count of being a felon in possession at the time of the chase, you would concede that those two convictions violate the double jeopardy clause because they're the same offense. I bet you wouldn't.
Judge, I'm sorry, can you re-ask the question? I apologize.
Two convictions for the same offense violate the double jeopardy clause.
Yes.
It is perfectly normal to prosecute somebody for being a felon in possession on date A and a felon in possession on date B.
Sure.
Your current attempt to save the sentencing enhancement seems to be that all felon in possession convictions are really just smirched into one. And so, therefore, the prosecutor could not separately prosecute felon in possession on the date of the bank robbery and felon in possession on the date of the chase because they're just one offense.
Judge, I think if we had indicted...
And that would be an extraordinary thing for the United States to be saying.
No, I don't think that is what we're saying, Judge, and that's not at all what I mean to be
arguing.
Well,
then there are two offenses, and then you've got problems under the language of 2K2.1.
There are two offenses, Judge. There's the felon in possession on or about February 14th, and then there's the bank robbery on February 14th. The on or about allows the government to introduce evidence of a time in proximity to that. It's not saying exactly on February 14th. And I think we did argue that there were multiple guns that could support that offensive conviction. In any event, Mr. Seals has not raised this argument, Judge. It's waived.
Forfeited, maybe.
No, Your Honor, I disagree. He was asked if there were multiple objections down below during the evidentiary hearing on sentencing. What the court said is there anything further that either side wanted to present to the court with regard to the sentencing issues that we discussed at conference? Or anything else. She's inviting him. The judge was inviting him to raise any objection that he possibly had. And he said, I don't think so, Judge. I don't believe so, Your Honors, were his exact words. The judge asked him multiple times, do you have any other objections? He said no. And I think to the point that you raised,
you about the 2C1.2 enhancement.
Sure, Judge.
That doesn't contain the same offense language.
Sure.
So are you arguing that if you flee from the police at any other time in your life, that enhancement applies?
No, Judge. It has to be relevant conduct for sentencing purposes.
No. Relevant conduct, if you look at the relevant conduct guideline, is limited to dollar amounts and drug quantities. And flight to avoid apprehension is neither a dollar amount nor a drug quantity, and so it's not part of relevant conduct.
Judge, I think it has to be tied into the offense of conviction for it to be applicable. I don't think we could introduce
some
evidence.
Language that you're particularly relying on to separate that from any other flight during the course of one's life?
There is not language I can point to specifically.
Normally, we interpret the guidelines to deal with the crime of conviction.
Correct.
2K2.1 makes that elusive. Part C as a whole looks like it deals with the crime of conviction. I'm having an awfully hard time seeing how things that happen a month later, potentially in a different crime, get included. One of the fundamental choices of the guidelines was to have a charge offense system rather than a real offense system, where the penalty depended on the charge and not on all the bad things you did in your life.
Sure.
There seems to be some transgression here.
I don't believe so, Your Honor, for the reasons I stated. I don't know what else to say other than there were multiple offenses of conviction. One of them was being a felon in possession, and there were multiple grounds to support that offense of conviction. Again, even if the court does have concerns about that, Mr. Seals hasn't raised that argument. Mr. Seals has waived all of his other sentencing arguments by making the specific objection that he did below and then saying he had no other objections.
If we were to remand on this basis, counsel, would you agree that these are matters that could be taken into account as part of the sentencing judge's exercise or statutory discretion?
Sure. I believe so, Your Honor, yes. Unless the court has no other questions, we'd ask that you affirm the conviction and affirm the sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Weiner, the court appreciates your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment and your assistance to the court as well as your client. Thank you. The case is taken under advisement. Our next